During the process of decomposition, a body can double in size. And then there's the smell. Death's perfume, described by experts as literally a chemical cocktail, produces distinct and highly unpleasant odours. The larger the body mass, generally the more intense it is. Think of the roadkill that attracts your attention as you drive by with the window down, even though there's nothing in sight. Depending on how bad it is, you'll have an idea whether it's more than a possum. When it comes to human beings, there are other factors as well. In research conducted since 2004 at body farms, those facilities that study such things in minute detail, it suggested decomposing humans have a scent all their own, different from anything else save the slightest similarity to pigs. So does the smell of death continue to alter and linger long after life is extinguished. I'm Nicole Overall, creator and host of Capital Crime Files, and in this case file fragment, I'm going down a slightly different road, looking at yet another aspect of the 50-year mystery of what happened to Karen Rowland, what went wrong in the search for her. Why did it take almost 3 months to find Karen when she was only around 10 kilometres from where she was last seen? Was there anything further that could have been done to find her earlier? And would it have made any difference to the investigation if she was? And finally, what about today? Is there anything more that could be done to potentially unearth some vital clue given the advancements to have occurred over 5 intervening decades? The Fairburn Pine Forest on Canberra's northeastern boundary, in which Karen Rowland's body was found on May 13, 1971, is, to put it mildly, a most peculiar spot. Near, though far, wedged between two cities, and yet still sequestered enough to be a hidey hole from prying eyes. As is the way of such places, unsettling too, particularly as dark descends. While some of the things to have gone on within may very well sit in the realm of the unknown, its reputation as a local haunt, literally and figuratively, is almost as well established as the trees that populate it. Indeed, many were regularly drawn to it for precisely those reasons. I've had the chance to discuss some of the associated activities with parties directly involved, among them dark rumours and accusations of witchcraft and satanic rituals. These aspects will be explored more fully in the next episode. In the meantime, as acknowledged by a variety of sources both at the time and those I've interviewed subsequently and discussed in previous episodes, Karen's body was not terribly well hidden. In fact, close enough to a dirt track to be within viewing distance. Within days of when she'd disappeared, likely around the very point when some of the most noticeable effects of natural decay were occurring, there'd been a training exercise for military personnel from the Fairburn Air Base. At the coronial inquest on September 24, 1971, it was discussed that the sergeant in charge had established that the Air Force men had been within 30 feet of the area where the deceased was eventually found, but he could shed no light on the situation at that time. And on April 3rd, just over a month after Karen went missing, more than 125,000 people descended on the neighbouring Canberra airport to mark the 50th anniversary of the Royal Australian Air Force, the RAAF. Of the other nefarious confirmed happenings going on behind the screen offered by those dense pines at much the same time, again to be discussed, it's logical to presume the area would have warranted some level of police attention. John Dow, a constable in 1971, having joined the ACT police from the Victorian Force, and who'd go on to become an AFP commander of the ACT region and recipient of the National Police Medal, has confirmed to me he was of the view it was odd it had taken so long to find Karen, For him, this was primarily because she was more or less visible from what photographic evidence supports as an apparently well-worn track. This sentiment is echoed by current AFP detective Sergeant Adam Reinhardt.
I'm very surprised that it took 3 months for someone to finally find Karen. It could be that people might have passed her and wondered what that smell was and didn't want to look at, because not many people would want to actually investigate the source of that bad smell. I mean, normally in Canberra it's a kangaroo, but in this case it was poor Karen.
While there's nothing that suggests any official search of Fairburn Forest occurred after Karen's immediate disappearance, it had been on the radar of family members and apparently certain others. It was just one of an untold number of places visited by Karen's dad, Jeff, throughout the region and beyond. He'd be joined in this by the youngest Roland, Karen's brother Steve. In the 50 years since the tragedy, Steve had never revisited the site of his sister's death until this particular anniversary approached. He's now of the view that they'd been looking in a different area to where Karen had been left.
We'd gone up the dirt road. That's now fenced off as part of the military firing range. At its tops, circled to the right, closer to where the memorial is. We then went back down the much rougher track to the main road, where it is now also gated. Karen had been left deeper north than where we'd originally gone.
Steve makes another quite critical point in terms of the disturbing possibility of what may yet remain unfound.
Not that you want to even consider such a notion, but if they'd taken her in any further, even 30 or 40 metres more, we may never have found her.
As presented in earlier episodes, the acquaintance who was with Karen for much of her final day, referred to here as Maureen, initially told police she and her brother-in-law had searched that very area on the Sunday after Karen went missing. When Maureen's brother-in-law disagreed with this recollection, she would later recant, suggesting she may have been confused. This, along with other variations in what would be three statements she'd make to police and questions that arise as a result, are also going to be looked at more closely as I progress towards the conclusion of this first season. At the least, these are yet further indications that for many, the Fairburn Pine Forest was a serious contender as a potentially ideal setting for hiding sinister secrets. Could it then have been explored better, both earlier and after the gruesome discovery? There were two other incidents to emerge at the coronial inquest which similarly give me pause in relation to searches, or a lack of them. Both will be covered at a later point in much more detail. However, in relation to the focus of this case file fragment, the outline will suffice for now. A patrol fireman stationed at the Canberra airport reported a bizarre incident occurring at about midnight on Saturday, February 27, the night after Karen's disappearance, although this would only emerge on the finding of her body. His statement revealed that during the course of his duties, he'd been stopped by a car with a number of occupants in the vicinity of the airport terminal. Getting out of the back seat, one female passenger claimed she was, to quote, Karen Rowlands. In the fireman's statement, she continued, "The police are looking for me. My car ran out of petrol on Parks Way. I am pregnant and I have had trouble with my boyfriend and I am going up to Mount Disaster to commit suicide." The girl also said to the patrolman, "Contact the police and tell them what I am going to do." On discussing it with his fellow employees, the fireman came to the opinion it was some type of joke. However, on his colleague's advice, he drove up for a closer look around the air disaster memorial, stating he didn't see anything further out of the ordinary and at that juncture dismissed it. The second incident was a sighting on the night of Friday, February 26. A young woman thought to resemble Karen running from a car outside the gun gate of Duntroon Military College, not far from where her white Mini Miner had been abandoned. This witness report emerged around a fortnight after she'd gone missing. Today, investigators still hold that it may indeed be of note.
The sighting of a person outside the gun gates or a little bit close to the gun gates is fairly significant information that was investigated fairly thoroughly and looked at in the coronial. I think that might give us a good, if that was Karen, a good sort of timeline of what might have happened.
And yet, there doesn't appear to be a record, or certainly not one made public, of any particularly thorough physical examination of those semi-rural surroundings themselves. This is in comparison to the noted extensive police searches reported as having taken place, some of which stemmed from witness claims of another unidentified car and a woman's screams. As previously presented, undertaken in bushland surrounding the small local hamlets of Bungendore and Tarago, both just over the ACT border in New South Wales. These locations not beyond imagining that something wicked could unfold, both very rural and relatively untroubled by traffic. 40-odd police and volunteers spent almost a week combing the surrounds. Time-consuming and resource-hungry, it all ultimately amounted to nothing. Clearly, though, taken seriously, despite no one ever coming forward to offer an explanation or reveal their involvement.
That's not to say that they're both unreliable. The gun gates, that could well be Karen, and the one at Doboy Creek, that could be Karen, or could be something else altogether.
Tip-offs and apparent sightings also drew investigators as far afield as Sydney and Melbourne. Through it all, Karen lying within mere kilometres of her own home. Back when they were still seeking Karen's whereabouts, between late February and mid-May of 1971, Western Australian politician Kim Beazley Sr. probed in Parliament if the ACT police were well-resourced enough to find her. The member for Fremantle also asked if, in his words, tracker bloodhounds were being employed in the task. It would seem they were not.
He was a typical Australian blue heeler, short-haired, dark grey flecked coat, two black bands over each of his eyes and pointed ears, split by a strip of lighter grey down his muzzle. Dubbed Senior Constable Blue Dog 342, he'd become a bit of a local celebrity after wandering into the ACT Water Police headquarters on the southern shore of Lake Burley Griffin in the mid-1970s. Adopted as a mascot as much as a watchdog, even given his own peaked cap. Blue Dog was, though, never a trained police canine. It was 1983 before two-year-old German Shepherd, Senior Constable Kaiser, became the ACT's first official recruit of this nature, working with the Bomb Data Centre. In a place of politics and its associated heavyweights, an acknowledgement of a significant avenue of assistance somewhat long in coming. In the event the need arose, bomb-sniffing dogs from Sydney were also called upon to back him up. Contemplating the noted history and various advantages of making use of canine sleuths, that word originating from Scottish slough dogs or bloodhounds, there were options in this regard available to the ACT police in 1971.
Here you are, doggy. Good old Toby. Smell it, Toby. Smell it.
This, how Sherlock Holmes set his tracking hound to work in the 1890 detective mystery, Sign of Four. Such crime-solving companions are famous in the popular culture landscape. Rin Tin Tin, the German shepherd rescued by an American soldier from the World War I battlefields of France, who'd star in films such as Tracked by the Police in the 1920s. In Modern Guise, the fictional Inspector Rex, also a German shepherd, aiding the Austrian-Italian homicide units. In the real world, the concept reaches back to the Middle Ages when parish constables kept bloodhounds for hunting down outlaws. Wrinkle-faced, droopy-eared hounds were used in the, albeit unsuccessful, pursuit of Jack the Ripper in 1889. 10 years later, Belgium introduced the first organised police dog service programme. The Germans, responsible for developments in breeding and training, selected their namesake shepherd as the ideal breed for police work. So are they cultivated for military purposes. One so trained, Strongheart, served with the German Red Cross during World War I and was another to become famous as a movie star. In Australia, the New South Wales Police adopted the first canine squad for searches, rescues and apprehending offenders in 1932, following the hunt for a vicious murderer across Depression-era Sydney. The spindly, jug-eared William Mad Dog Moxley abducted 21-year-old nursemaid Dorothy Denzel and her 25-year-old boyfriend Frank Wilkinson, a newspaper typesetter, from a lover's lane in the city's west. Moving between locations, Moxley brutally raped the dark-haired beauty queen Dorothy and beat Frank senseless before shooting them both. A massive, labour-intensive manhunt over more than 2 weeks saw the killer tracked down in French's forest, some 40 miles or 65 kilometres from where his victims had been dumped in shallow graves. Moxley was hanged at Long Bay Jail, the first execution in New South Wales in almost a decade. A subsequent police review determined trained dogs would have done the job of locating him much more efficiently. Thereafter, Zoe, a big, white-coated Alsatian, after the wars the breed routinely referred to as such, was one of the early recruits. Earning much attention as the first radio-controlled police dog, she'd respond to commands from a receiver she wore strapped to her side. The farlap of police dogs, according to her handler, Constable Scott Denham, Zoe was equally loved by the public, making regular appearances to show off an incredible repertoire of 380 stunts. Most importantly, during 10 years of service, she was acknowledged as having located more than 100 missing people. Despite this, and other stellar achievements by the New South Wales Canine Squad, come 1954, it was officially disbanded, according to the Australian Police website, not reinstigated until 1979. In relation to a still unfound Karen Rowland, when tracker bloodhounds were asked about in federal parliament, the response didn't address the prospect for making use of such animals. The Minister for the Interior, the Honourable Ralph Hunt, at that point in charge of Canberra's administration and to whom the question was put, would have known the ACT and New South Wales Police didn't then specifically have this capability. Nonetheless, it hadn't previously stopped the Canberra authorities calling in assistance from further afield when needed.
Monday, September 3rd, 1962, and Dawn, Australia's top tracking dog, attached to the Commonwealth Police Tracking Station in South Australia, was flown into the ACT to assist with the search for a missing boy, Nicky Summers. The 7-year-old German Shepherd had earned a widespread reputation 3 years earlier for helping in the sensational pursuit of career criminal Kevin Simmons. After the 24-year-old convicted armed robber escaped Sydney's Long Bay Jail, a warder at a prison farm was slain. The tousle-haired, handsome Simmons remained on the run for 37 days, garnering considerable notoriety before being brought undone in rugged scrub in the Hunter region, about 93 miles or 150 kilometres north of Sydney. His end was as tragic and as inglorious as his exploits. 6 years into his life sentence, he'd be found hanging in his cell. Dawn's job on the occasion of her visit to the capital was to help find the blonde, 8-year-old Nicky, who'd wandered off in rugged country at the headwaters of Gudgeonby River, 30 miles southwest of Canberra. So were the army called upon to assist. Considered some of the toughest landscape in Australia, after 2 nights in near freezing temperatures and having covered almost 7 miles, the worn-out little boy was discovered.
In a more harrowing local example, although not a trained police dog, an Alsatian called Ede made the macabre discovery of a body in what remains Canberra's oldest unsolved murder. When 6-year-old Alan Redston failed to return to his family home, in the tight-knit southern suburb of Curtin on the evening of Tuesday, September 27, 1966, a huge search was quickly underway. At daybreak the next morning, it was Ede who alerted his master, a friend of the Redstons, to a spot in the swampy bed of the Yarralumla Creek, not far from where the boy was last seen. There Alan lay, wrapped in a carpet, brutally bound and strangled.
A dog and its owner going for a leisurely walk. But what makes this walk different is that Gary Jackson and his Labrador Asia aren't just passing time. They're working. Asia has been set a very specific task, to track down a scent rising from this 1 acre field. Such a minute amount of scent that you or I wouldn't be able to detect it. Scent of a dead human body buried deep beneath the ground.
That's another segment from the archives of Channel 7's Australia's Most Wanted, screening from 1989 to 1999. Such highly trained animals are taught to focus on the unique combination of odours that constitute the death smell of humans, to the exclusion of all else. With modern studies suggesting accuracy of some 98%, cadaver dogs, or human remains detection, HRD dogs, weren't specifically recognised in an official capacity until the early 1970s in the US. Pearl, a Labrador retriever, famous as the first exclusively trained in this way, located the remains of a dead college student 4 feet underground. For Australia, it was much later this valuable resource was provided for locally. Craig A. Murray's website, dogschool.com.au, declares him the first to train what he identified as an Australian cadaver dog. Subsequently involved in, as detailed, dozens of murder investigations, this included the 1993 search of the place that earned infamy as Ivan Milat's killing field, Belanglo Forest. More recently, HDR dogs have gained considerable prominence, including in Australia. March 2021, there was headlined in the media a new tactic when cadaver dogs were brought in to help in cases including that of Victorian campers Russell Hill and Carol Clay, missing since March 2020, New South Wales woman Ruth Ridley, who disappeared in 2019, and subject of the Lighthouse podcast, backpacker Theo Hayes, last seen alive near Byron Bay in New South Wales, also in 2019. Not only recent investigations either. In mid-2020, a property on the Gold Coast in Queensland was searched by cadaver dogs for 32-year-old Tina Greer, missing since 2012 and believed murdered by her bikie boyfriend. Regardless of all this profile, rigorously trained death hounds are still not as commonplace as dogs used for other activities, such as drug detection. The costs involved in resourcing and ongoing training, and, somewhat incongruously, suggested low demand for their specialist skills, are the most often presented arguments. So too, questions on effectiveness and how findings are potentially presented in court. In 2021 Australia, limited numbers of cadaver dogs are only formally attached to the New South Wales Police Force and since 2006, the Queensland Police Service. Their work is supplemented by a small community of volunteers dedicated to similar pursuits. Along with such activities as locating humans lost in large outdoor environments, these accredited groups assist in tasks as specific as seeking out remains in a variety of underwater circumstances. The Australian Federal Police has a division of General Purpose, or GP dogs, their services made available nationally and internationally. Among their roles, searching open and rural areas for offenders / missing persons, tracking from a last known location, and searching for physical evidence containing human odour. It was, of course, a very different state of affairs in 1971 Canberra. Nonetheless, when it came to both the initial search for Karen Rowland and even immediately following the discovery of her body for what else might have presented including, perhaps, traces or the scent of a person of interest, there was another potential option at hand.
At the RAAF base, Fairburn, between the Canberra Airport and the Pine Forest, also so named, trained patrol dogs have been enlisted as official military members since at least 1963. Originally an army concept, these units were introduced to the RAAF in 1954, complete with recorded names and service numbers. One of the early intakes for Canberra made the grade as PD, Police Dog, 379 Noro. Attached to the security guard unit, a Canberra Times headline article on June 27, 1968, confirmed their primary role. They guard RAAF stations by night. As it turns out, such animals have also been used for other serious incidents and crimes. One example, the attempted murder and abduction of the Indian military attaché to Australia, Colonel Iqbal Singh, in 1977. Subjected to deep stab wounds by an intruder to the embassy, the diplomat and his wife were thereafter taken at gunpoint. They made their way escape following a struggle with the would-be assassin while travelling along the Monaro Highway, leading to Cooma. As detailed at the time, two RAAF tracker dogs were brought to the scene and given the scent from a duffel bag left behind. While unable to locate any trackable leads, an important deployment of available resources in order to bring about a prompt resolution.
Is there any reason why RAAF dogs, or other dogs for that matter, might not have been considered in assisting in the search for Kerrin, given the notion was raised in Parliament and when alleged sighting locations were specifically nominated? The fact remains that inter-agency cooperation between the military and law enforcement is relatively routine. In 1979, there was even a push for a National Canine Academy in order to take the best advantage of these working dogs. 8 years earlier, at the least, might such an option have ensured the searches conducted to try to find Kerrin and follow leads covered more ground more efficiently, allowing better allocation of time and resources for prompt attention to other tip-offs and follow-up? And what of the potential for seeking out remaining traces after the grim find? Scent, clothing, or belongings from any of the more than 30 persons of interest who made it onto the police list? Even anything more of Kerrin herself? Once Kerrin was found, perhaps it was thought the scene was too old. Some of you out there listening might be thinking exactly the same thing. And yet, there's been some incredibly interesting developments when it comes to some very old cases. As recently as May 2021, in the UK, a cadaver dog alerted on a spot beneath the concrete floor of a cafe linked to an alleged 15-year-old female victim of Fred West, he known to have killed at least a dozen, from 53 years earlier. Best-selling author Kat Warren, in her book What the Dog Knows, Scent, Science, and the Amazing Way Dogs Perceive the World, includes examples like Rufus sniffing out a missing woman buried 4 feet underground for years, who was also beneath a layer of concrete and lime. So is it easy to find documented examples of dogs finding bodies missing for years, decades, and even centuries, as well as other materials potentially helpful in solving cold cases? Sometimes they find nothing at all. Far from fruitless, such an outcome can be revealing in a totally different way. Perhaps 50 years later, it is little more than academic. But what of the potential for any historic traces that may remain? On what would have marked the date of Kerrin's 70th birthday, December 9, 2020, and which just happened to coincide with the release of this podcast, the AFP undertook another search in the vicinity they believed Kerrin's body had been found. Again, as mentioned previously, precise records on the exact position apparently don't seem to exist. On that occasion, metal detectors were used, for the first time. According to police PR, an effort to see if that elusive missing bracelet Karen apparently had with her that February night might be unearthed. While suggested to be taking advantage of new technologies, inventor of the telephone, Alexander Graham Bell, came up with the concept of a metal detector in 1881. In 1925, they were made portable, and 6 years after that were in large-scale production. 40 years on, in 1971, they weren't uncommon, popular among treasure hunters and for revealing landmines in war zones. Also used in crime busting, to locate metallic physical evidence, sometimes even bodies themselves. An infamous case to employ such a detection aid, along with infrared equipment, was the search for victims of Juan Corona in a Californian orchard of death at the end of May 1971, only weeks after Karen's body was found. Over in the US, they discover 25 corpses of itinerant workers. The murder spree of Corona, a contractor of farm labour who died in prison in 2019, made him at the time the deadliest American serial killer by number of proven victims. In 2020 Canberra, with some criticism of attempts to detect the bracelet as little more than an exercise in optics, it went some way in confirming the jewellery wasn't present, and therefore it remains a critical and unaccounted for piece of evidence. The technique of geoprofiling has also figured in Karen's case, that the more in-depth analysis of what the environment might reveal about a crime. It was broached in relation to the Fairburn Forest as part of yet another TV show on Ivan Milat. A local connection couldn't be established beyond reasonable doubt. With all of these elements in mind, if all avenues of investigation are truly to be considered, what of the possibility of a modern-day dog search, even if only to prospectively rule out anything else of significance? And or, what of something even more technologically advanced, like drones and ground-penetrating radar, acronym GPR? Most notably, GPR has been used in the Kristen Smart case, which gained huge international attention and two arrests through the 2019 podcast Your Own Backyard. 19-year-old Kristen disappeared from a Californian university campus in 1996. At this stage, her body remains unfound. During podcaster Chris Lambert's in-depth exploration of the cold case, it was revealed GPR was used in associated locations. So was a cadaver dog brought in. The radar pulses used to detect objects and irregularities underground were said to have revealed an anomaly. The dog was also reported as having alerted in similar areas, areas that had subsequently been concreted over. On the very day I was researching this aspect, July 28, 2021, there were brand new reports of authorities using GPR technology as they continued to look for Kristen's body in rural Arroyo Grande, following multiple tips received from the public. One final question to ponder in our own backyard then. Would such resources, of the official or voluntary kind, potentially be useful, not only in relation to Karen Rowland, but any of the other unsolved cases that have occurred within the orbit of the Australian Capital Territory over five decades, many with a connection to the other local, similarly difficult to access, even impenetrable, forests of the region. At the outside, could such endeavours at least rule out beyond doubt that there's anything more to reveal? As I continue to burrow ever deeper, connecting with experts in these very fields, keep watching this space and listening for what I hope will be some very interesting developments in this regard. Coming up in Capital Crime Files.
My sister telling a story of she'd drive up to the air disaster memorial at night purely to be scared.
While I'm busily preparing the next episode, you can keep track of other developments, previews and news, including that relating to other potentially relevant cases, by following us on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. You can also find out more about me professionally by taking a look at my LinkedIn profile. We'll talk again very soon.